next case.
Case number 08-7127. Tanisha Mills et al. Appellants versus District of Columbia. Mr. Hayden Hillard for the appellant, Kim for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning, Counsel.
May it please the Court, I'm Mara Verhaden Hilliard on behalf of the appellants, and with me at counsel table is Carl Messinio. This case presents a challenge to the District of Columbia's Neighborhood Safety Zone program, which is an extraordinary program in which the police authorize setting up checkpoints without any individualized suspicion, that barricade neighborhoods, that conduct suspicionless seizures, and as such, under this program, were it allowed to stand, it would fly in the face of the Supreme Court's rulings in Edmonds as recognized by this court in Davis.
What do you mean by extraordinary?
Sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't.
What do you mean by extraordinary?
There's been no recognized circumstance by this court or the Supreme Court where a police may establish a system where they, in essence, seal off a neighborhood, set up barricades and checkpoints surrounding that neighborhood, do not allow anyone to enter that neighborhood without stopping at the checkpoint, and where the persons who are subjected to that Fourth Amendment seizure at the checkpoint then must submit their reasons and pass
well, that's,
by...
That's a description of the program, but... If it's extraordinary, presumably that means it's not ordinary. It's beyond the ordinary for this department.
It is beyond the ordinary from anything that we have seen this department do and beyond the ordinary for anything that has been recognized by the Supreme Court. The program, well, the Supreme Court has been clear that roadway checkpoints threaten fundamental civil liberties and that they may be allowed only under very limited circumstances. That specifically checkpoints operated to advance the general interest in crime control are constitutionally impermissible. And this case poses the question of whether this checkpoint system, whether a barricade system operated for the purpose of crime deterrence, falls within the prohibited category of checkpoints operated for the purpose of general crime control. And we believe the answer is that they do. That these checkpoints, as I described, are deployed with the identification of an area within the District of Columbia. The triggering mechanism for the checkpoints under the special order as delineated by the police department is the presence of crime. There is very general terminology as to the existence of crime and violent crime that becomes the predicate for setting up this type of checkpoint. Once the checkpoint is set up, then, as I described, persons are not allowed to travel further on a public roadway. But once reaching the checkpoint, unlike other checkpoints where persons are stopped, under these circumstances, they're not even allowed to travel further on that public roadway unless they have met very specific criteria that the police department uses to determine whether persons have a legitimate reason. The legitimate reasons that the police department has delineated are simply not coextensive with lawful reasons for traveling down a public roadway. But the police department, in the District of Columbia in this case, have identified that the use of the six criteria that they use is in essence to profile persons to determine whether they are persons who are likely to engage in criminal activity. And in so doing, they are stopping people who, for example, might want to go get groceries. That's not a permittable reason to travel on a public roadway. To go see a friend is not a permittable reason to travel on a public roadway. So persons who are not, who are not thought to be engaged in any crime or going to be engaged in any crime are subject to this type of stop and further not allowed to travel any further. It is our belief that the lower court erred in a particular distinguishing respect, which was that it found that the programmatic purpose of the checkpoint system was one that fell outside the Edmunds prohibition on this kind of program for the general interest of crime control. Indeed, throughout the special order authorizing the program, the Metropolitan Police Department refers over and over again that the establishment of neighborhood safety zones is an effective law enforcement tool for addressing violent crime. In all versions of the special order, they represent that the purpose of the neighborhood safety zone is to provide high police visibility, prevent and deter crime, safeguard officers and community members, and create safer District of Columbia neighborhoods. What the lower court determined was, and we believe erroneously, was that deterrence of crime somehow fell outside the prohibition on the general interest in crime control. And further, the court in its programmatic assessment asserted that deterrence of crime that was asserted to be based on the use of a vehicle to commit a crime somehow then fell outside the prohibition on on checkpoints for general interests of crime control.
Let me ask you, the District of Columbia begins its brief by saying you can't show irreparable harm.
I'm sorry? I couldn't hear the second.
Sorry. The District of Columbia begins its brief by saying you have failed to show your entitlement to a preliminary injunction because you can't show irreparable harm, as the District Court found.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that there is absolutely irreparable harm. Under the circumstances of the plaintiffs in this case, the irreparable harm is a constitutional injury. It's an injury to which the plaintiffs have already been subjected and are at likelihood of being subjected again, as is any resident of the District of Columbia. The Neighborhood Safety Zone program authorizes enacting these type of checkpoints and barricade systems anywhere in the District of Columbia. The plaintiffs in this case are drivers and residents of the District of Columbia. The harm comes, as the court has recognized, from the seizure of a checkpoint. A checkpoint seizure is a seizure for the purposes of Fourth Amendment.
Say again the last sentence you said, please.
The court has recognized that a seizure at a checkpoint is a seizure for the purposes of Fourth Amendment recognition. And the seizure at a checkpoint of the plaintiffs, or anyone else for that matter, is indeed Fourth Amendment imposition, and it's a violation of their Fourth Amendment rights, we would assert. For the plaintiffs, they should have the freedom not only to travel down the roadway without being stopped and seized, but further, they should be allowed to travel without any suggestion.
The irreparable harm is a sentence saying what the irreparable harm is.
The irreparable harm is the deprivation of their fundamental constitutional rights.
Yeah. All right, but the district court says it is in no position to predict when the factual preconditions, this is JA 94, 95, for a roadblock which is considerable will exist again. I am not convinced that the risk that the MPD will implement additional roadblocks during the pendency of this litigation would be great enough to satisfy plaintiffs' required showing on irreparable harm. What do you understand the district court's finding to have been?
The district court and the District of Columbia advocated at the initial preliminary injunction stage in the initial hearing that indeed it was only conjectural that neighborhood safety zones would ever be deployed again, even though the special order remains in full force. They never took down the special order. So long as the special order remains, the chief of police of the District of Columbia, and this is acknowledged by the district, has stated that she intends to continue to deploy neighborhood safety zones until a judge orders her to stop. But notably, the district, for example, in this case, filed, I believe, on July 18th, 2008, a statement with the court, again arguing it was only conjectural that neighborhood safety zones would ever be deployed again, such that relief should not issue, and 24 hours later, deployed another neighborhood safety zone. So long as the special order remains in force and is not rescinded, so long as the chief of police is stating that she intends to continue to use them, and so long as the trigger for the special order for the implementation of the neighborhood safety zones is in fact the presence of crime and the presence of violent crime, when the District of Columbia and the MPD and its own statistics say that, for example, between August 2007 and August 2008, there were some 34,000 crimes in the District of Columbia, 8,000 of them being defined as violent crimes, that's 8,000 opportunities a year which would legitimize the deployment of a neighborhood safety zone barricade program.
So did you understand the district court to be saying that he was finding that the plaintiffs had failed to show that during this litigation, it was likely that the district was going to implement this program again, or that the plaintiffs had failed to show the imminence of this injury? I mean, you went off on several points, and I just want to be clear what your understanding of his ruling is. I'm going to ask the District of Columbia the same question.
Our understanding of his ruling, and contextually it may help, in the initial argument on the motion for preliminary injunction, the judge at that time, the lower court at that time, in fact said that he thought it would be very unlikely that the District of Columbia would actually come out and deploy this again while it was before his court. And yet they did, several times again. Then again, when it came, as I mentioned before, to supplemental materials filed with the court, the district was saying it was conjectural, and then again they deployed it again. So our understanding of the court's ruling, in a certain way, was almost an admonition, again, that he did not think, as he had said before, that they would deploy them again in the course of the litigation, but the district did deploy them in the course of the litigation and has said that they will deploy them again. And they've acknowledged that they've said that they will deploy them again. And they have not temporarily suspended, as they could, or otherwise rescinded the authorizing order.
So is it your position then that the district court clearly erred in that finding that you had failed to show it was likely?
To the extent, Your Honor, that the court in its opinion is saying that the plaintiffs have failed to show it's likely that the neighborhood safety zone program will be deployed again. We believe that would absolutely be an error. And for the assessment of standing at the time and place, in fact, for the preliminary injunction, that standing assessment is made at the time of the commencement of suit, which the suit was commenced in June of 2008. There was a supplemental pleading that was filed in August of 2008. And we would say that the period of time to evaluate that position would be those 2 months in which the MPD did repeatedly deploy its checkpoint system.
Yeah, that may be conflating two questions, and it may be understandable. But assume you have standing. We hadn't asked you, people might object. We assume you have standing. It's still a question of whether the district court plainly erred in concluding you had not established irreparable harm. Because this is an extraordinary remedy. I understand it's an extraordinary remedy that happens all the time, but we still call it an extraordinary remedy. And you do have to show the four elements, one of which is the irreparable harm. And it is a clear error review, isn't it? Or am I wrong about that? So I think Judge Rogers asked you, are you saying that the district court clearly erred in finding that you had not established irreparable harm?
Absolutely. We believe the court erred in not finding that plaintiffs had established irreparable harm. We believe that the harm incurred from the establishment of neighborhood safety zones, the idea that, in fact, a person cannot travel to a friend's house or to the family or to anywhere on a public roadway without being subjected to this type of questioning from the District of Columbia and further being barred from traveling down the street. The idea that at any point in time an entire neighborhood can be barricaded and persons, including the plaintiffs, are barred from entry, either because they do not meet the District of Columbia's limited legitimate, so-called legitimate criteria test, or because they choose not to disclose to the police department their personal contacts, their associations, the phone numbers of their family members, where they want to go, the meetings they want to attend, the addresses or locations of where they want to go. That's an extraordinary seizure program, and one that the district has said that it will deploy and redeploy, and in fact has done so.
Counsel, am I correct in recalling that the officer is supposed to get information he can verify?
Pardon me?
Am I correct in recalling that the officer is supposed to get information he can verify?
Correct.
And does that mean he's supposed to verify it?
Yes. The special order states, including in its subsequent and all revisions, that the officer is directed to stop the car and ask for information as to the purpose of the travel down the street, that the person, the operator, and or the passenger, because there is a plural in the special order as to inquiring of persons in the car, must identify then where they're going and what their purpose is. If that purpose then falls into one of the categories, the six very limited criteria for travel, then the officer is to verify that.
How do they verify it?
They say that they can verify it by you can provide a phone number, which the police can call of a person to say, are you expecting this person? Is this what you're doing?
And does the record show that they do that?
Their records show, their after-action report, I think, shows simply the number of cars that they stopped and the number of cars that they let through and the number of cars that were turned around. I don't recall whether it said the number of phone numbers they took, but they both
Well, that would certainly affect the, if they actually call the number to verify, it certainly affect the intrusiveness.
The intrusive, yes, the fact of both the special order and the training instructions for the police, and they say that the police, every police officer must be trained in accordance with the training instructions, all of them direct the police officers, this is the course, that they ask for phone numbers and address information, that you must provide phone numbers and address information, or for example, proof of legitimacy of a meeting.
Well, you can give that information in a moment. The question is whether they actually then hold you up while they go verify it.
Well, the police say that they do. Their assertion is that in compliance with the program and the programmatic requirements that eliminate discretion is held out in the special order and in the training program for the police officers, that in fact they must. It says at the record at 105 in the Neighborhood Safety Zone special order that they must require proof of the reason for entry. The operator must provide information sufficient for the member to verify the accuracy of the reason. This may include, but is not limited to, a telephone number or the address to which the person seeks entry, which the member may use to verify that the resident slash occupant expects the persons and or an invitation to a verified, organized, civic, community, or religious event.
So he doesn't have to actually do it, which the officer may use.
Well, if they weren't doing it, then it would suggest that the program is operating in a discretionary fashion. I believe the district is relying on the assertion that it does not operate in a discretionary fashion, that, in fact, it fully and completely complies with the directives to the police officers.
Well, we have, as has become our custom this morning, talked to you beyond your time. So unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the appellee, and we'll give you back a couple of minutes in rebuttal, assuming they say something you wish to rebut.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. May I please the Court? Todd Kim for the District of Columbia. The district court here had two independent reasons for denying the extraordinary remedy of a preliminary injunction. Either is sufficient for this court to affirm. The simpler reason is the plaintiff's failure to show the necessary, certain, and great risk of irreparable injury during the course of this litigation, although we'd be happy to discuss the merits if the court wishes as well. But let's begin with irreparable injury. Plaintiffs present only conjecture that they will suffer the type of irreparable injury that they claim before this
Excuse
court.
Excuse me, Mr. Kim, did you mention the second ground?
I'm sorry.
You said what the second ground is?
What's your second reason?
The second ground would be just the merits. There are two independent grounds that the court relied on, irreparable injury and merits. The simpler is the irreparable injury, but again, I'll be happy
to... So you mean the likelihood of success on the merits?
That's correct, Your Honor. As to the irreparable harm, case law in this court and the Supreme Court makes quite clear that to justify the issuance of a preliminary injunction, a plaintiff must present evidence of a threat of irreparable injury that is certain and great, not conjectural and hypothetical. We have many different cases in both the Supreme Court and this case to which the plaintiffs don't respond that show that this is a real requirement and conjecture and hypothetical information is not enough.
You would agree, would you not, that the burden can't be to show that, in fact, the department will do this again during the litigation?
Absolutely agree, Your Honor. If you look at, for instance, the O'Shea case in the Supreme Court itself recognized past instances in which an injury has occurred are some evidence as to the future likelihood. But then we have to turn to the actual future likelihood as demonstrated by the evidence in the record.
And in this case, you have the repetitive use of this program within a short period of time in the same place for the same reason. And the police chief saying she's going to continue to do it until a judge tells her not to.
True enough, Your Honor, but a couple things to note with regard to that. You mentioned repetitive. We have two instances. We have two instances in the course of a year that this program has been active. Two. We have two instances in a particular neighborhood, but that does not suggest necessarily, certainly not with the sufficiency necessary to satisfy the plaintiff's burden, that this will appear again in this neighborhood particularly, let alone within the period of this litigation.
Would you concede that if they, I'm not asking you on the merits, but as far as this element, if they had shown that this occurred with greater frequency, say, to pick a number out of the air, they were doing it once a week, would you concede that was enough to make out irreparable harm?
Only as to one part of their necessary showing. Another part of their necessary showing would be not just to show that these checkpoints would occur again, but that they personally would be subjected to these checkpoints.
Well, all right, that is bringing me to what I am sort of getting to. Even if they are not personally planning to go in there on a particular day, but they regularly drive around the District of Columbia, is this hanging like the Sword of Damocles? And is that hanging enough to make out an irreparable harm?
It's hanging like the Sword of Damocles only in the sense that any particular provision of law, be it a statute or a special order, could be invoked at any particular time. But I think it's well established in this court that the mere pendency of a legal provision that would allow putatively unconstitutional action is not enough to provide you with standing to challenge it for purposes of injunctive relief. Of course, we don't dispute that they have standing to pursue their damages claim, which remains pending in the district court. But to justify a federal court's invocation of its equity power to issue the extraordinary remedy of a preliminary injunction, plaintiffs have to do more than that.
They have plaintiffs, do they not, Mr. Kim, who community organizers, leading people who have a lawful reason for being in this particular area about which they have cause them to come into court.
Certainly they do.
What more would they have to show? You know, it's like the bird watchers who are going to go back to the forest to watch the birds.
I don't think it's quite that based on the record evidence in this case. Their reply brief says that this particular person about whom you're speaking, Ms. Leakes, returns often to this particular area. The record does not actually substantiate that. What the record substantiates is the notion that she returns to this area with some regularity. The word is regularly that's used. We don't know based on the record whether it's daily.
Is that different than often? Is there a constitutional or a judiciable difference between regularly and often? Or with some regularity and often?
Whether it's regularly or often, the plaintiffs bore the burden to show their entitlement to the extraordinary remedy. In order to bear that burden, they would have to show some certain and great likelihood that they would encounter one of these checkpoints. We have
plaintiffs here, one of whom at least lives in the cordoned area, correct?
Well, actually, according to the notice of suggestion of death that the plaintiffs have presided to the court, that plaintiff has passed away.
That's the one that died.
Right. There are no residents of Trinidad. He was actually not a resident of even the particular areas that were declared as neighborhood safety zones.
We have another whose work takes her regularly into this area.
That's right. But we don't know. Well, there are a couple things to say with response to that. First, we don't know how regularly, and I've said that. Second, they make the point in the reply brief, but not in their opening brief as to this. They don't point to particular things in the record to substantiate this notion that they will encounter these with regularity. They merely argue, as they did in the district court, that these checkpoints will occur again. So there's a forfeiture question here. There's also a forfeiture question with regard to their particular allegation that there's a lingering stigmatic effect from the existence of this program. A couple problems with that, again, they haven't argued that properly. But even assuming there is a lingering stigmatic effect, again, their burden is to show a threatened injury that is certain and great. They don't show how this stigmatic effect affects their personal interests in any great way. They don't provide a magnitude for that effect at all.
If there's a stigmatic effect, assume that for the moment, then the stigma is already attached and continues.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Until dispelled by the program being, in their view, declared unconstitutional. So they're suffering that harm on a continuing basis because they've been stigmatized already.
Right. Again, however, they didn't even argue that in the district court or in their opening brief, so this is forfeited. It's forfeited, and this court, of course, can satisfy itself of that. Moreover, again, the stigmatic effect, without some indication how it affects their personal interests, and remember, none of the plaintiffs who are before this court actually even live in this area. Absent that, that's no reason to overturn the district court's decision. I'm also happy to entertain questions on the merits.
You might want to speak to the merits.
I'd be happy to, Your Honor.
You really think you can win this on the merits?
I absolutely think
can
we
the
do,
district
Your Honor.
Set up a checkpoint that doesn't let anybody in, let anybody into an area who wants to go in there and buy groceries or just wants to drive through to get to the other side, likes to take pictures of buildings? Can they really just set up checkpoints at the decision of the police to do that?
We fully recognize, as the mayor recognized, that this is an extraordinary program. Both parties agree the mayor...
Well, there's no question it's an extraordinary program. Forget it's an extraordinary program. Tell me whether they can constitutionally do this.
Right. The one of the main points to emphasize here is that the program here has a programmatic purpose that's dependent on a narrow invocation of past crimes that lead to a threat.
What's the narrow standard, and how does this take it out of the general crime control category?
Two things, Your Honor. First, let's emphasize what the district court here found as a matter of fact, which they don't challenge. The district court found the programmatic purpose is not to uncover evidence of ordinary criminal wrongdoing, but to deter violent crime facilitated specifically by the use of vehicles in neighborhoods recently victimized by spikes in
violent
crime.
What takes deterrence out of the general crime control category?
I'm sorry, I'm having a
hard
time.
What takes deterrence out of the general crime control category?
I think what takes deterrence out of the general crime control category first is the fact that the general crime control category, as referred to by the Supreme Court in Edmund and Lidster, refers, we believe, specifically to detecting ordinary evidence of criminal wrongdoing by the drivers actually stopped. The Lidster court, I believe, made that precisely clear. So their invocation of that phrase is unmoored from the way the Supreme Court itself has said that phrase should be understood. If we're even to say,
what's your best case for saying that deterrence is a valid constitutional reason for a checkpoint on traffic?
I would point the court to the Lidster and Edmund cases themselves, actually. In Edmund itself, and remember this is the case upon which plaintiffs relied most heavily, the court recognized that its holding did not call into doubt whatsoever that authorities could use suspicionless checkpoint programs, much like we have here, to do things like thwart an imminent terrorist attack. Now, I understand there are distinctions that can be drawn.
Much is a kind of a difficult word there. Much like we have here, is there one that's justified simply on the subject of deterring a broad category of crime in the area surrounded by the checkpoint?
I'm sorry, I'm having a really hard time hearing you because...
Is there a case, and I understand, I've been having a hard time hearing the whole argument, I understand fully, but is there a case that upholds a checkpoint where the articulated reason for the checkpoint is deterrence of a broad category of crime?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but it's the Maxwell case in the Second Circuit. But I also believe that your articulation is one we disagree with somewhat. We're not talking about deterring crime generally. The district court here was quite specific that we're talking about thwarting imminent crime where there has been a neighborhood that's been victimized by a recent spike.
The category of crime indicated is deterring crimes of violence in which automobiles are used. That's a pretty broad category.
Not just crimes of violence in neighborhoods that have been recently victimized by spikes in crime. And the word spike is significant. It signifies the district court's recognition that what the neighborhood has recently experienced is atypical. And so what we're talking about here is not general crime control at all. It is about the chief's, if I may submit, very reasonable response to the ongoing problem of crime waves in neighborhoods that see far too much crime, specifically crime waves where people drive into these neighborhoods and shoot people up. And the chief has had experience, and, of course, we have to defer to the chief.
Could they set up a checkpoint that barred everybody except residents from coming in? Could they constitutionally do that?
I think they could, Your Honor. I think the fact that they have actually allowed people to come in is to the chief's speaks well to the constitutionality of this program, but I don't think it's necessary.
What's the rationale for allowing elderly persons to come in?
I'm sorry, I can't.
Why are elderly persons allowed in?
I think, as the district represented in the district court below, these legitimate purpose criteria are intended to be a rough guide for excluding those who the district believes.
Well, being elderly isn't a purpose. It's a status. Being elderly is not a purpose. It's a status.
Yeah.
I agree, Your Honor. And perhaps there's imprecise phraseology here. We don't dispute that the six legitimate purpose criteria may be over-inclusive. Indeed, wildly over-inclusive. We agree that most people who might go to a neighborhood for grocery shopping or to visit a friend don't go with the purpose of wreaking these crimes.
How old is elderly?
It's undefined, Your Honor. I would hesitate to say.
It is undefined.
Yes, absolutely it's undefined. But
and what makes a person whom an officer subjectively thinks is elderly admissible where one the officer thinks is perhaps not, the officer is as reluctant as you are to define it, how does that affect the likelihood of the commission of crime?
Well, I'm not sure that it's necessary for in each instance the exclusion to be directly tied. We're talking about the reasonableness of the program of seizures overall.
Each exclusion from the stoppage has a concomitant inclusion in the stoppage. There's some other category of persons who can't come in, the non-elderly. How does why are the non-elderly excluded and the elderly are allowed in?
Well, Your Honor, first, let me step back. I don't believe this argument's been properly preserved. They've raised a Fourth Amendment claim. They don't raise, for instance, a Fifth Amendment equal protection claim. The notion that the seizure and the scope of the seizure and its reasonableness should take into account all the possible permutations of who and who will not be allowed to enter, I think is inconsistent with the definition of seizure. If we're talking about a Fourth Amendment claim, we're talking about the period of seizure, which ends, according to the Supreme Court, with the end of the termination of freedom of movement. So we're not talking about the reasons at the end of the inquiry. We're talking about whether the reason for the seizure is...
Let's talk about intrusiveness. That's a Fourth Amendment concern.
Absolutely.
The order tells the police to obtain information sufficient to verify that one of these reasons exists and says they may verify it. Is that correct?
That's right. It says that they should obtain information reasonably sufficient to verify the reason asserted by the driver who stopped.
And that they may verify it.
Absolutely. That's right.
Okay. So if they may verify it, that means making a phone call, for instance?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't that intrusive? The person's waiting there while the police dial someone to see if they're expected?
We don't dispute that it's intrusive to some extent, but weigh the level of intrusiveness against that which the Supreme Court and this Court has upheld.
Well, your argument is that these stops are brief and just long enough to supply the information, but it's not true. The information's subject to verification, which may take any amount of time and may not be possible.
Well, Your Honor, you look at the actual undisputed evidence in the record as to how long these stops actually lasted. There's no dispute, according to all the declarations on the record, that when people pass through, they pass through in a matter of seconds. And I would note, according to the evidence of the record, 95% of the people pass through. And as to that remaining 5% who were stopped, the declarations indicate people return to side in about a minute. Compare that with case law that establishes that similar programs have been upheld. Look at Martinez Fuerte. Look at the Sitz case. Look at Lidster itself. In all those circumstances, stops that were at least as intrusive, if not more, were upheld.
Lidster is, I think, your best case. But as I understood it, the court was trying to draw a distinction between sort of opening the floodgates to roadblocks and a rationale that, well, the police have the right to ask any citizen questions in the course of investigating crime. So the fact that they're doing it by a roadblock as to a past crime in a limited area seems to us to be reasonable. But given that the Supreme Court has always prefaced that by saying we're very reluctant to extend exceptions to the individualized suspicion, I guess it's a question of how far you think Lidster can carry you, where in this particular situation, it's the same neighborhood that's had these roadblocks imposed over the years. That's what's troubling me, where, you know, prior to Lidster, it was pretty clear the Supreme Court was talking about things not having to do with crime control.
Right. We don't dispute that the stops in Lidster were different from the stops at issue here. So we don't contend that Lidster is controlling in every respect. We do think Lidster has significant guidance for the court in resolving this case, and you can look to our brief for that. But to address the question of what we do if Edmund and Lidster don't control, first, we think that plaintiffs haven't properly preserved that, but going beyond that...
Haven't properly preserved what?
They have argued in this court, and look at page one of their brief, their argument is that Edmund controls.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They don't argue that this court should establish its own rule of law going beyond Edmund. But even assuming this court were to forgive that forfeiture, let's talk about whether or not this court should establish its own rule of law. Remember, the ultimate touchstone for the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. And we are fully cognizant of the fact that stops without individualized suspicion are viewed with suspicion by the courts.
Yeah.
That's not to say that there won't be exceptions. Indeed, the Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized such exceptions in some circumstances. The question were whether these circumstances are sufficient to justify.
Generally, where stops have been upheld, people who were not violating the law were allowed to go on about their business. Is that not accurate?
No, that's absolutely accurate, but I don't think that distinguishes
here,
in this case.
They were not allowed to go on about their business. They had to turn around if they didn't meet six sometimes subjective criteria. Right?
Well, it depends what you mean by go about their business.
They couldn't go into the area on the other side of the checkpoint.
No matter what
their reason for going there was, unless they met six fairly subjective criteria, right?
I'm sorry if these sound like quibbles, but I don't think they are. First, they were not prevented from going to the area. They were prevented from going
from driving into the area.
Precisely. Officers were instructed to tell people who were stopped, you may park right here and walk in a maximum of two or three blocks, point one. Point two, the six criteria that are listed are not universal. There's, in fact, also a catch-all. So,
what's the catch-all?
The catch-all is a sergeant may approve the entry when there are exigent circumstances. Okay, so perhaps that doesn't satisfy every legitimate purpose. We wouldn't dispute that, but I just wanted to correct the court's factual misimpression there. But going on, if we consider the
that
reason...
That is the most subjective one yet, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
That's the most subjective one yet, isn't
absolutely.
It? Okay.
This program does not suffer from the type of discretion that the Supreme Court found objectionable in Prowse, and plaintiffs raise no argument that it does. I'm just merely making the point that even officers who are following the rules as set forth in the officer will have to make some decisions as to how to apply the rules. But going back, the ultimate touchstone of the Fourth Amendment, again, is reasonableness. Plaintiffs here want a flat injunction saying that a government may never establish a checkpoint program for any deterrent purpose. So they would say...
I don't think they have to win that argument to win this one, do they? They're not asking about ever. They're litigating with you about this...
Well, I'm sorry, I humbly disagree. I think they are arguing that every deterrent purpose is proscribed. So,
where did they argue that? Can you give me a quotation that says that?
Sorry, I don't have a quotation. I'm happy to look at the brief and send a letter to the court.
We've talked to you pretty well beyond your time too, counsel. I had moved my computer in front of you, but we're about 5 minutes over, so. Unless my colleagues have further questions.
May I just finish the thought I was...
Okay, finish it quickly.
If the court accepts that their argument, and they establish no limiting principle, is that deterrence is simply proscribed as one of the permissible purposes under Edmund and Lidster, the necessary implication is that even if the District knows that somebody is entering into a neighborhood with the purpose of shooting people there, the chief may nonetheless not set up a checkpoint program for purposes of keeping that person from even approaching there.
If the chief knew that objectively, I don't think you'd get to the checkpoint question, would you?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
We have your argument, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the appellant in rebuttal. You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. I will speak very quickly. Just on the last point, the district is arguing against a case that is not the case that we've put forward. We've never argued that, for example, a sobriety checkpoint or a license registration checkpoint or the description that the Supreme Court's given suggesting that under certain circumstances, if a terrorist or a known killer was fleeing in a certain direction, they couldn't set up a checkpoint. We're not arguing that those checkpoints can't exist. The district has used a moving target kind of argument repeatedly with regard to the irreparable harm issue. They've said that the only point in time in which anyone could ever challenge a checkpoint would be apparently at the moment at which you're standing at a checkpoint. And because Afterwards, it's too late. Beforehand, you don't know they're going to do it. And as we know last time, they deployed checkpoints on 45 minutes notice. I would note that in the Edmund case, injunctive relief issued where there had been checkpoints just on 6 occasions, and that relief was allowed to go forward. With regard to the district's argument that, in fact, the plaintiffs have not put before the lower court issues of the stigma attached and damage to Linda Leakes, it's indeed in the supplemental pleading before the lower court and in this record, pages 18 through 39 of the supplemental pleading, I believe. With regard to...
I have no idea what you just said.
Pardon me?
I have no idea what you just said.
Let me try it again.
While you were looking down and mumbling, what was it you were saying?
What I was saying is that the district is incorrect in its statement that the issue of damage to Linda Leakes, the stigma attached to Trinidad, and the other related issues going to that position were not put before the lower court and are therefore not before this court. They are in the supplemental pleadings at the lower court stage. They are part of the record in this case. There is a lengthy discussion of that in the supplemental pleading. The district's statement that that the issue only comes up only deployed when there's a spike in crime, one must evaluate this at the programmatic level. The programmatic level in the special order says that checkpoint implementation is in response to reported criminal incidents, including homicide, shootings, robberies, and other offenses as approved by the chief of police. And furthermore, the Trinidad checkpoint they did deploy, what they now say was deployed because of drive-by shootings or persons driving in shootings, they pointed to only one that had occurred in the previous 6 months at that time. And finally,
you actually are out of time now. I'll give you one moment.
I thought I had 26 seconds. I realize I'm going up and not down. And finally, I would note that when evaluating the intrusiveness issue, the intrusiveness, again, is also evaluated from the programmatic basis, from the special order and the definitions in the special order, as opposed to at the operational, the operational
Thank
level.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until Monday morning at 9:30 a.m.